of that. Okay, good. Thank you. Am I supposed to put this in the pocket? Okay, I hope it works now. So we are going to discuss the topic that can be considered probably somewhat old-fashioned. But nevertheless, as it was mentioned on the lectures on statistical physics, if you look at the literature, you will be surprised how much you will find about the Ginzburg-Landau approach. Not only in superconductivity, but also in other areas of condensed matter. But first of all, let me remind you what we did before. We considered this BCS Hamiltonian to derive the lowering of energy of the ground state due to the transition into the superconducting phase. What we see here, and this was one of the problems for the tutorials, and I don't know how many of you managed to do these problems, but the answer was written on the tutorial sheet, and the answer is that whenever the transition to the superconducting state occurs, the energy of the ground state is lowered, and is lowered by the term proportional to delta squared, where delta is the superconducting gap. Delta disappears at some kind of critical temperature, but the difference in energy is proportional to delta squared. This just means that the paired state is more advantageous than unpaired one. So we can ask a question. Is this a general result, or this is just the consequence of this simple model, the simplest possible that allows the description of transition to the superconducting state? And the answer is, this result is very general. Indeed, when the transition to the superconducting state occurs, the energy is lowered by the term proportional to delta squared. So the purpose of today's lecture is to consider the theory that does not require a lot of microscopic input to justify it, but is nevertheless very general. So the topic is Ginzburg-Landau theory. This theory was created by Ginzburg and Landau in 1950. It's remarkable that they created this theory around 9 years before this Hamiltonian was in fact written. So they took a completely phenomenological approach without even knowing what is the mechanism of pairing in real metals. Later, when this Hamiltonian was nevertheless written, Gorkov in 1959 showed how to derive the Ginzburg-Landau action I am going to write from this Hamiltonian. I don't know if many of you know that Ginzburg received the Nobel Prize several years ago exactly for the work done in 1950. So what were the assumptions made by Ginzburg and Landau? They were very simple. They anticipated that superconducting state appears as a result of some kind of the change in the ground state, namely some kind of coupling between electrons in metals. So they anticipated that there must be something called order parameter that acquires the non-zero value when we go below the critical temperature. And this something is the density of paired electrons. So they introduced the so-called order parameter, psi, complex that is the density of Cooper pairs, local density of Cooper pairs. They assumed that it can somehow change in space, and it is complex, so we can write that psi is equal to the square root of nsr times some complex phase multiplier, I e in power I theta r. So this is this phase determines the superconducting current, as we will see later. These were the assumptions, and they assumed that close to the critical temperature, this density, the density of paired electrons, is small. Then we can take the thermodynamic potential called free energy and expand it in powers of this order parameter. So they assumed that they work near the critical temperature and stated that near TC, psi is small, as well as the gradient of psi. So we can just write down, based on general rules of quantum mechanics, the expansion in terms of this parameter and the gradient of this parameter. So if you have any questions, so don't hesitate to ask. The free energy density, and if the total density is just the integral over volume of the free energy density, so the total free energy density is denoted by capital letter, and F is then denoted by a small letter. So they wrote down the following, that the density, the free energy density of the superconducting metal compared to the free energy density of the normal metal is equal to alpha psi squared plus beta over 2 psi in power 4 plus 1 over 2 m star minus I delta minus E star A psi squared plus the term that takes into account the possible presence of a magnetic field in the system. So this is the difference of free energies between the superconducting metal and the normal one, written close to the critical point. Here, alpha, first of all, beta must be positive. This is the condition for stability. And alpha changes sign. So near the critical temperature, it can be written in the following way: alpha prime T minus TC divided by TC. So TC is presumed somehow known, or in other words, we can write alpha prime times T, where T is what standing here. So when T greater than TC, we have alpha greater than zero, and when T is smaller than TC, then alpha is negative. So the transition is governed by changing of sign of this coefficient alpha. I have written this functional assuming that H bar and C are equal to one. This is just for notational simplicity. So this is what was written, based on completely phenomenological assumption, based on the assumption that the physical meaning of this psi is the wave functions of Cooper pairs that in the ground states are all in condensate. That's all. That's all. Cooper pairs have charges 2e, hence E star is equal to 2e. So when Ginzburg and Landau wrote this theory, they already anticipated that electrons are somehow paired, somehow paired. So they postulated, and let me write down this as a comment, comment one. E star is equal to E because of pairs. Because of pairs. But what is M star? They have anticipated that because electrons appear, then M star is equal to 2ME, where ME is the mass of a free electron. But strictly speaking, if E star must be equal to 2E, M star can have simply the dimensionality of mass. So the convention is that M star is equal to 2ME, but we have some other coefficients, alpha prime and beta, that we can somehow renormalize to ascribe essentially any value to M star. But these are the details of how related to how this free energy density could be derived from a microscopic theory. Then, one more comment. Later, in 1959, when Gorkov showed how to derive this difference, it became clear what coefficients alpha prime and beta are. In fact, and I'm not going even to mention how one can derive this expression from this BCS with coupling Hamiltonian, it's quite complicated. So questions? Do you have questions? Yeah, Akosa.
Did they just write down this equation like this from space, or they had some argument to?
So the argument is psi is the wave function of the condensate, only charged condensate, because by 1950 people started to develop the theory of superfluidity in liquid helium. So atoms in liquid helium are neutral, but it was understood that, and this was also what Landau received essentially the Nobel Prize for. It was understood that in the ground state, all atoms of liquid helium four, their bosons, are in condensate. And condensate can be described of the wave function. And the wave function is simply the wave function of the state corresponding to p equal to zero. Quantum mechanical wave function, and it must be constant in the ground state. So they anticipated that they deal with charged superfluid. So they could construct this free energy density simply by making their reasonable assumptions for how to expand with respect to psi. Of course, for example, it is completely clear that there can be no linear term because psi is strictly speaking complex, or cubic term for the same reason. But they also knew what how to describe elementary excitations on top of these wave functions in liquid helium. This is just the standard kinetic energy in the form of the gradient term. So if the charge fluid in magnetic field, then let's add the vector potential in the usual quantum mechanical way. That's all. So when this connection between this expression and this BCS Hamiltonian was made, it became clear that alpha prime is the density of states at the Fermi surface, then psi squared coincides with the square of the gap. When we write the microscopic Hamiltonians, we typically use the letter capital delta, and in Landau theory, we typically use psi. So these things are the same, they're only notationally different. And beta has some particular value. 6,6 density of states divided by TC squared. These two coefficients were obtained based on this type of Hamiltonian. But strictly speaking, and especially this is true for beta, these coefficients are material dependent and are derived only from a weak coupling BCS theory. But strictly speaking, since this is the simplified model, beta in terms of values may vary quite substantially. Good. So any questions at this point? So if there are no questions, let me erase everything except of this expression for the free energy density. Actually, this eraser is somewhat better. So, So, let's consider first the case and what follows from this free energy density when we don't have any magnetic field. In this case, we have so uniform case, no fields. What we mean by uniform case, we mean that we neglect the spatial dependence of psi. And do see simply the midfield treatment. So we have here delta F equal to alpha psi squared plus beta divided by 2 psi in power 4. So if alpha is greater than 0, then delta F depends schematically on the absolute value of psi in this case and in this form. And it has one minimum when the absolute value of psi is equal to 0. The minimum. Then, if alpha is smaller than 0, case 1b, alpha smaller than 0, then delta phi has the following form. It has the form of the Mexican hat potential with two minima as a function of the absolute value of psi. And in this case, if you minimize, and it's a trivial exercise, you will obtain that the absolute value of psi that equal to the absolute value of psi naught is equal to minus alpha divided by beta and square root of this. So alpha is negative. Alpha is negative, and it is typically denoted as psi naught. So we can assume that psi naught is, of course, real and positive. So if we substitute this psi naught into this difference, then we're going to get delta phi is equal to alpha over 2 psi naught squared, or minus alpha squared divided by 2 beta. Let me, before I will consider other cases, let me write down this expression in the following form. Alpha t minus tc divided by tc, I'm sorry, alpha prime, divided by 2 psi naught squared. So what happens if we put here t equal to 0? We will obtain minus alpha prime divided by 2 psi naught squared if t is equal to 0. Well, if we do this and compare with what is written here, remembering that alpha prime is equal to n, to equal to the density of states at Fermi surface, we will recover quite identical expressions. Well, one can ask a question. This energy was derived when alpha is close to the critical temperature. How can it give the result from BCS theory being extrapolated to the case t equal to 0? What E, is this fortuitous, or is this some kind of a magic? Well, the answer is, if you look carefully at the microscopic derivation of this free energy density from the weak coupling BCS theory, weak coupling, then you will understand that it's not fortuitous, because when you say do some manipulations with this interaction term, provided that V is small, then you will essentially organize the so-called double expansion with both small v and small value of the order parameter. So if we try to confirm, to derive this theory from the weak coupling BCS Hamiltonian, then we indeed obtain that the change of energy, even down to zero temperatures, coincides with what we can obtain from mean field BCS theory. But once again, let me emphasize that this expansion is quite general with arbitrary alpha prime and beta, and does not rely on the weakly coupled BCS Hamiltonian. We can use the case of weak coupling, we can use the case of strong coupling, but we will obtain the same form of phenomenological free energy difference. Then, let's consider the other cases. Let me erase this Hamiltonian. I will no longer need it. And consider case, what happens if we include magnetic field? So I will derive only one very simple result. The result what the critical magnetic field should be that destroys superconductivity. You probably heard when John was talking during the first lecture about the properties of superconductors that there exists the critical magnetic field H, above which superconducting state is not possible. And this expression allows us to calculate what the critical field is going to be. Or better to say, the maximum possible critical field. So we have case two. Alpha smaller than zero in this otherwise superconducting state, but non-zero H. Non-zero H. So you see that this term is negative, and H increases the energy difference. So eventually, large enough H will make the difference between superconducting and normal metal equal to zero. So we write that F and non minus alpha squared divided by 2 beta plus HC squared divided by 8 pi equal to the density of the normal metal. So we essentially can deduce that HC is equal to the square root of 4 pi divided by beta times the absolute value of alpha. So HC near the critical temperature behaves as TC minus T. So the smaller the alpha, the smaller the critical field is necessary to destroy our superconductor. Let me make the following comment, but first of all, any questions about this simple algebra? Okay, and so no questions. So let me make the following comment without writing anything. Of course, strictly speaking, in real systems, the real critical magnetic fields are smaller than HC. The reason is that this result is strictly speaking true for the cylindrical sample of infinite length placed in magnetic field in such a way that the field is parallel to the axis of the cylinder. I'm not going to talk why this is true, because in real finite size samples, the critical fields are smaller because one can observe the so-called intermediate state in which the regions of superconducting phase alternate with the regions of non-superconducting phase. And when this happens, superconductivity is partially destroyed. So this value is the maximum possible value of critical fields that follow from thermodynamic theory. So, but anyway, I'm not going to discuss this anymore, but let's assume that if you have an infinite sample, then superconducting sample, then magnetic field applied by some kind of external source, then the critical field will be given by this formula as follows from this Hindenburg-Landau theory. Then, finally, one more thing related to this expression. Let's now consider the case. So no fields, but allow for the spatial fluctuations of the order parameter. So what happens if we make one more step above the mean field treatment? So in this case, the energy difference will be, and let me rewrite this in the following form. Take out alpha and write psi squared plus beta divided by 2 alpha psi in power 4 plus 1 divided by 2 m alpha and the gradient term. So let's look at what stands here. This quantity, 1 over 2 m alpha, is denoted as minus psi squared, it depends on temperature, and is called the coherence length. Why? Because if we start considering fluctuations, and fluctuations, of course, cannot be considered based on the assumption of non-spatial dependence of psi, this is something on top of mean field theory. If we start considering fluctuations, then this parameter psi, having the dimensionality of length, characterizes the effective scale on which the fluctuations are developed. But this follows if we calculate just the correlation functions of superconducting order parameter at different points. And obtain that they decay exponentially. So this exponent will be the correlation length. When T is equal to zero, then this correlation length, so at low temperatures, gives the characteristic size of a Cooper pair in a superconductor. This can be also obtained from quantum mechanical treatment of BCS Hamiltonian. I decided not to give you this exercise. But close to the critical point, when we approach TC from below, the correlation length diverges. So you should simply be familiar what the correlation length is, that it has the dimensionality of length. As follows from this term, because we have the gradient here. And so what is the physical meaning of this? Okay, question.
I was just about to ask that. What's the physical meaning of the size of the Cooper pair?
So this, the size of the Cooper pair. A good question. So if the physical meaning is probably as follows. So if you take two electrons in the metal and bring them close enough so that the distance between them is of the size of the Cooper pair, then the wave function of the system will look like the wave function of the paired state. So if you move them far apart, then they become independent. So this is just the formal thing that follows from quantum mechanical treatment if you solve the BCS Hamiltonian just for two electrons in the system. It's quite a standard exercise, so assume that you have two electrons and pairing between them. So what's the characteristic size on which electrons become almost independent. So in a more general sense, the pairing in the field theory is described by Bessel-Peter equation. So that the vertex function has poles, it has pole in momentum space, and this pole corresponds to the inverse correlation lens. But this is just the field theory in mathematics, so it's just probably for those of you who saw these things. Anyway, good. Good. Then let me erase this and write down this difference in free energies here on this board, because in the second half of the lecture I will refer quite often to this expression. Okay. So what we're going to talk about now is called Ginzburg-Landau equations. So let me write down the energy difference here. Delta F equal to alpha psi squared plus beta psi in power 4 divided by 2 plus, here I believe there is minus I nabla minus E star A psi squared plus H squared divided by 8 pi. So this is the free energy, or better to say the free energy difference. Then what happens if we have magnetic field? We have external magnetic field, and if we put superconductor in this magnetic field, then magnetic field has some kind of a spatial dependence inside the superconductor. Question, how to determine it? How to determine self-consistently the spatial dependence of the order parameter and the spatial dependence of ensuing, accompanying it, magnetic field in the bulk? And this is what Ginzburg-Landau equations, in fact, do. So what we need to do, we need to minimize this free energy difference with respect to psi and with respect to A. Or in other words, take the variational derivatives of this delta F integrated over volume over psi and the variational derivative with respect to components of the vector potential. This is what we need to do. First of all, let me tell you that taking the variational derivatives with respect to psi is quite simple. We just need essentially to differentiate over psi effectively over psi, and that's it. I forgot 1 over 2 m star, of course, here. So, and that's it. So let me just write down the result. If we take the variational derivative with respect to psi, with respect to psi star, because if we want to obtain the equation on psi, we must variate with respect to psi star. So if we do this, we will just obtain the following. A is kept untouched during the variation process, and we have 1 over 2 m star minus I delta minus E star A. This is squared psi plus alpha psi plus beta absolute value of psi squared times psi, and all this is equal to 0. This is the first Ginzburg-Landau equation. Then to obtain the second Ginzburg-Landau equation, we must take the variational derivative with respect to A. I'm not going to do all the algebra because apart from this term and H, I'm sorry, I should have told this earlier. H is connected with the vector potential according to the following nabla cross A. Actually, this is the curl of A. So, of course, H here and A here are not independent. They are connected with standard definition from electrodynamics. H is curl of A. So to obtain the equation that essentially describes the behavior of A, we must vary what stands here and what stands here. So as a result of varying what stands here, and I believe you were asked to do this in the course on quantum field theory when you considered the complex scalar field coupled to electromagnetic field. So if you vary what stands here, you will just obtain the current, the standard quantum mechanical expression for the current. So yes?
H to be totally external, or you can consider it
fantastic question. In the upper,
outside of superconductor, H plays the role of external field, or basically it is external at infinity. So inside the superconductor, it is internal. And even outside, because magnetic field creates the internal current, non-dissipative current, inside the bulk of a superconductor, then these currents self-consistently generate their own fields that affect the external field over even outside the bulk of the superconductor. So at infinity, it is external. So if you vary this term, you will just obtain the standard quantum mechanical expression for the current. If you vary this term, then you will obtain something else. And let me just very quickly do this algebra. So if we vary the integral dx of curl A squared, so I would like to emphasize here one trick, that's why I will do this algebra, is equal to 2 curl of A dot curl of delta A dx. So yes, then we use the following relation, that curl of A dot curl of delta A equal to nabla dot curl of A cross delta A plus, and here we have something very interesting, nabla cross A delta A. So this is the formula from vector analysis that is quite beautiful and is quite often used in electrodynamics. So I decided to remind you of this formula. So here we have curl of curl A. Here dot. So if we substitute this formula into this expression, then this is the full divergence, and integrated over volume, this term disappears. So we are left just with this term, meaning that as a result, we get 2 curl of curl A delta A dx. Of course, when we vary, not to forget this 8 pi. So the prefactor 2 will give you 1 over 4 pi in denominator. And if you do everything and introduce the current J, the expression for the current obtains, as I mentioned, due to variation of disturb. Then you get, so, but let me first write down the expression for the current minus E, minus I E star divided by 2M star, psi star grad psi minus psi grad psi star minus E star squared divided by M star A psi squared. Don't forget about the presence of this term. Then you will obtain the following. Our second equation. Curl A equal to 4 pi times J, where J is given by this. Or let me write down, because I will use this, delta, I'm sorry, nabla cross nabla A plus 2 pi I E star divided by M star psi star grad psi minus psi grad psi star minus 4 pi E star squared divided by M star A psi squared equal to 0. So I decided to write down these two equations in full. So this is our working equation number 2. So this system of equations is called the system of Ginzburg-Landau equations. This is what obtains when we take the variational derivative of this delta f with respect to psi and with respect to A. just the following comment. Yes?
Where?
The last term.
The last term. Where? In the second formula? Saying plus or minus here. So 2 pi. Yeah, plus. Thank you very, very much. Thank you. Very much. Of course, plus. In my notes, I wrote in one line plus and the other line minus. So the following comment about this system of equations. First of all, this system of equations is non-linear. Why? Because of the presence of the q cubic term here. Moreover, A is itself a variable. And the presence of this variable A here makes the system of equations even more non-linear. Of course, if you know, fortunately, sir, that this second equation is linear with respect to A. So this, strictly speaking,
makes the exact analytical solution of this system of equations quite complicated. But nevertheless, people devoted a lot of efforts to solving the system of equations for various situations in various limits. Any questions about the derivation of the Ginzburg-Landau equation? Yes.
Good question. Good question. This is what I was beginning to talk about next. To talk about that. So let's look at this expression for the current.
And assume that we prepared our superconductor in such a state that the absolute, that the magnitude of the order parameter is constant. So if psi is equal to psi naught, actually this psi is a function of r, psi naught times e phi as a function of r, then if you substitute this expression here, then you will get that J is equal to E star divided by M star psi naught squared. And here you have the following. The gradient term with respect to phase minus E star A. So what's this? This is the so-called velocity of the supercurrent. This multiplied divided by m star. So let me write down this thing here. Vs equal to grad phi minus E star A divided by m star. This is the velocity of supercurrent. The velocity of electrons, better to say, in the supercurrent. Then if you use this definition and take into account that psi naught squared is the super is the density of Cooper pairs, then you will get E star NS times this VS, times this velocity of supercurrent. A familiar expression known from the theory of motion of electrons in normal metals. E times concentration times velocity. Only here we have the charge equal to 2E. Concentration is the concentration of Cooper pairs, and velocity defined this way. The physical meaning of this velocity is that we slightly perturb with this non-zero phase already your uniform condensate. If we do this, we obtain quantum mechanical current with velocity of electrons given by this expression in this current. This follows purely from quantum mechanics. And this current is what we mean by non-dissipative steady current in superconductors. And of course, if you substitute this definition, you will get that this is equal to m star and s v s squared divided by 2. This is the density of kinetic energy of electrons in this supercurrent. So returning to a series of your questions, Akosa, by the moment when this Ginzburg-Landau theory was written down, it was already known what was going on in liquid helium and why this non-dissipative current of particles that are neutral in liquid helium, how this current should obtain. So this is nothing else than the kinetic energy of the system once it is somehow perturbed from from its uniform ground state. Now, one last thing. So can I erase this portion? Let me erase this. So we need not only this system of equations, we need the boundary conditions, because of course superconductors are not alone, they are put in vacuum. One can consider a system in which a superconductor borders normal metal. So we need the boundary condition. And the boundary condition in this problem is quite simple. The point is, we can't have non-dissipative superconducting current provided it goes in parallel to the boundary. So if we have the boundary, where this is superconductor, and here non-superconductor, it can be vacuum, it can be metal, then we must state this condition, and I will just write it down, and make one comment. So, minus I nabla minus E star A psi, and we take the normal component. This is just the notation to the normal component of this vector, is equal to I psi at the boundary divided by some parameter B. This parameter has the dimensionality of length and has a very particular physical meaning. Look, if you have the superconductor here and non-superconductor here, say metal or the dielectric, then your order parameter decays somehow and very quickly in the area, in the region of non-superconducting materials. So I would say even draw it this way. So this parameter B is the characteristic length of the decay. Of course, if we have vacuum or more generally dielectric, for insulators, B equal to infinity. But if we have metal, then typically B is of the order of several, say, interatomic spacing. But we can have here not only metal, but we can have here another superconductor at a slightly higher temperature than its own critical temperature. So if we have here a superconductor slightly above the critical temperature, then this parameter B can be quite large, because the superconducting order parameter here undergoes somehow fluctuations in this neighboring superconductor that it's near its transition, its own transition to a superconducting state. This, the phenomena observed in such systems, are very beautiful and constituted in the past a very, very extended area of research. So for such cases, B can be very large. So B is, strictly speaking, of course, a temperature-dependent parameter. But this is just the comment that these equations need to be supplemented by this boundary condition. That's essentially all I wanted to tell you about these equations. And in the remaining couple of minutes, I would like to tell you when and where these equations are useful. First of all, they're useful if we want to consider how external magnetic field behaves or how superconductor behaves under the influence of a magnetic field. It's quite unfortunate that I'm giving only one lecture on this wonderful topic, although in my notes I have provided the solution to a simplest possible problem one can address you using this system of equations, the problem of penetration depth of magnetic field inside the bulk of the superconductor. So essentially what happens, and I will use last 2 minutes. So what happens is that when you have, say, a superconductor occupying the space, say, x is smaller than zero. So if you have here the superconductor, and if you apply magnetic field parallel to the surface, say, here, then the magnetic field will decay exponentially into the bulk of a superconductor. And the characteristic length of this decay, delta, is given by the following formula. Delta is equal to m star beta divided by 4 pi e star squared alpha. This parameter is called London penetration depth. And it can be obtained from these equations and under certain assumptions. And so, and unfortunately, I don't have time to talk more about these assumptions, just reiterating that the primary goal of these equations is to address the question of what happens if superconductor is placed in external magnetic field. So that's all, my friends, and thank you very much for your attention. Okay. Thank you.